So now we'll move on to the second venture case. This is number 05-1537, Venture Industries Corporation versus Autoliv. And again, we have Mr. Green.
May it please the court. Autoliv in this appeal is appealing the court's denial of its motion for a new trial pursuant to Rule 60B2 and Rule 60B3. The issue we submit on our appeal is whether the court applied an improper legal standard on the B3 and the B2 grounds. But before I address that, I would like to respond to the question the court instructed that we be prepared to respond to in argument.
It's a little surprising that neither side cited Frage or Schreiber in their briefs. They seem to be fairly pertinent cases, even though they're not applying Sixth Circuit law. They are our cases.
Yes, Your Honor, they are. All I can say, I think, to that is at the time we became involved in the 60B motion, the way it was framed to the district court, it did not seem that it would be appropriate at that time in that court to be raising a claim as to a duty on the other side to advise the court. But if I may address the court's question, our view is that Venture's counsel and Venture itself did have an obligation to apprise the court and apprise Autoliv of the information regarding the unreliability of their reported financial statements and the information regarding the unreliability of the statements at the Grand Blanc plant. That's the plant where the covers would have been produced, which they call Vemco. And those statements, they also had an obligation, we submit, to tell us that they had restated those plant statements to make corrections. The statements were relied upon by their expert, in part, for his damages calculation. They were produced
to us.
But
at the time the counsel discovered the problem with the financial statements, the case was on appeal?
Yes, the case was on appeal.
So that's a difference from Schreiber.
It is a difference from trial, Judge, but I don't think the duty to apprise the court and the opposing party of material facts that you have learned have been misstated or were incorrect or incomplete expires at trial. If we look to Rule 26E of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure or Rule 3.3 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, neither rule terminates such a duty at the time of trial, and the model rules make it very clear that such a duty terminates only at the conclusion of the proceedings, which the comments to the rule explain to be the time at which all times for appeals have expired.
So haven't you waived this point by not raising it in your brief?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we've waived the point. Our point is they did engage in discovery misconduct, and the judge was wrong in that, but the standard he applied is wrong, and it doesn't matter whether it's discovery misconduct or not. What matters is whether or not there was a deliberate act of fraud or misrepresentation in the case. So we believe that whether the court agrees with us that there was a duty to disclose and agrees with us that we haven't waived it, then that would be clearly discovery misconduct. And either under even under the standard Judge Cohn applied, then our 60B3 motion would be granted. But we also take the position that if the court were to disagree with us or believe we waived it, the appropriate standard under 60B3 is not limited to discovery misconduct. It's any misconduct or fraud that takes place and affects the procurement of a judgment.
Well, what's the standard here in terms of showing a relationship between the fraud and the jury verdict? I mean, here we have a situation where Judge Cohen has made extensive findings about the lack of relationship, and he says, he concludes that this would not, that if the correct information had been made available, that this would not have affected the jury verdict. And the question is, while those findings were made in the context of the B2 motion, the newly discovered evidence motion, why doesn't that carry over to B3 and show that there's no effect on the jury verdict from the fraud, if we call it that?
So there are a few questions embedded in there, Judge. Let me try to take them in order if I can. The standards under B2 differ from the standards under B3 as an initial matter. Under Sixth Circuit law and the Jordan Packard case we cite,
which is a non-precedential.
Well, it's an unpublished case, but under the local rules in the Eastern District of Michigan, parties are allowed to cite that case if they believe it has precedential value. And under the standard articulated in that case, Judge, once a party shows that there has been a fraud or a misrepresentation, any deliberate act of the type of misconduct referred to in Rule 60, then there is a presumption in all cases that it has had a material effect, unless the opposing party can show by clear and convincing evidence that there was no prejudice at all. That's under Rule 60B3. Under Rule 60B2, the findings Your Honor was referring to, we believe the court applied the wrong standard to determine what is and what is not material. What the court essentially did is to take the evidence.
They applied the wrong standard for B2 purposes?
For B2 purposes as well, Your Honor, because what the court essentially did is it took the misstatements that had been identified in the various forensic accounting reports and tried in an isolated fashion to quantify them in dollars and cents to see how much they would or they wouldn't have affected Mr. Levko's testimony, and then ultimately relied on Mr. Levko's statement that they wouldn't have changed his mind at all. We submit that's the wrong way to look at the evidence. The way the evidence should be looked at is not in that balkanized, compartmentalized sense, but as a whole. And the proper question is, if the jury had heard this evidence, would it likely affect their outcome? Would it probably affect their outcome? That's essentially what we submit with the Schreiber case also says.
I'm not clear. What, in terms of B2, how did he apply the wrong standard? As I understand the standard under B2, it's whether it clearly would have resulted in a different verdict.
That is the standard, but I submit, Your Honor, what that standard means, and it's similar to what this court determined in its, I think back in 1985, in its Yachts America case. That's a probability assessment. And the question that has to be asked is, if the jury heard this, would it probably result in a different outcome? And I don't think that's what the court did. I think the court...
Well, what was different about what the court did?
The court tried to quantify how big a difference the evidence would make in its mind and determined, relying on Mr. Levko's testimony, that it wouldn't have made any difference because Mr. Levko said he wouldn't change his mind. I think that's actually inconsistent with the court's own comments at the close of the April 29th evidentiary hearing, when the court stated on the record, gee, if the jury heard that, it really would have caused them to doubt. It would have colored the trial.
Okay, but what about the B3 standard?
On the B3 standard, prejudice does not have to be established by Autoliv, because under Jordan versus Packard, as soon as there is a deliberate act of the type of misconduct referred to in Rule 60, prejudice is assumed in all cases, unless the other side can show by clear and convincing evidence that there's been none at all.
And did you argue, because on the B3, it seems that the district court's focus was virtually entirely on the discovery fraud.
Yes.
But did you argue something other? I mean, what we're talking about, what you've been talking about with Judge Dyke, is not the discovery fraud issue, but that other aspect of B3.
Yes.
Was that raised?
Yes. The whole April 29th evidentiary hearing and the briefs we submitted after that hearing are all about the misstatements in their financials. We did not claim in that hearing that they didn't give us those improper financials. Certainly we had that argument that there was discovery misconduct as well, but that was not the sole argument. We had an independent argument that the whole April 29 hearing was about was the misconduct and fraud here, was the reliance by the expert in his damages model on evidence that was tainted by fraud or misconduct. And the court essentially ignored that argument, Your Honor, and dealt simply with discovery misconduct, which is inconsistent with the wording of the rule. The rule contains no limitation that the only kinds of conduct it can consider is discovery misconduct. The Lonsdorf case from the Seventh Circuit makes it clear that the misconduct doesn't have to take place in the proceeding, much less in discovery. Indeed, the rule itself, when it talks about fraud and says, including what was previously referred to as extrinsic or intrinsic fraud, extrinsic fraud, when they used to use those terms, was fraud outside the case. Intrinsic fraud was fraud in the case. So the conduct...
But the judge ultimately concluded, after an extensive discussion of the facts and the witnesses' testimony, that even assuming the fraud, I mean, I think we can infer from what he said, even assuming the fraud, didn't he conclude that the other side, even if it has the burden that you suggest under Jordan, had met that burden? Because there was absolutely no relationship between the relevant testimony that their damages witnesses gave in terms of damages and the so-called reliance on the fraudulent information.
I think in the B3 section of his opinion, Judge, he did not conclude that.
We take his discussion of that testimony under the B2 and
no, because I don't
place that in the B3, and therefore doesn't his discussion and his analysis and his conclusion with respect to the relevance or non-relevance of the fraud aspect?
No, Judge, I would submit you can't do that, because even if one were to apply his B2 materiality analysis to the B3 argument, all the court in his B2 materiality analysis found that Autoliv had not presented evidence, clear and convincing evidence, that would show it had a material effect. He did not find that Venture presented evidence that by clear and convincing evidence to show that it had no effect at all. Indeed, his own comment at the close of trial, I think, is just the opposite. Moreover, there was evidence we submitted in connection with the B2 of an expert witness, Mr. Dages, that showed using Mr. Levko's own methodologies and own assumptions for testing the effect of these misstatements could be as much as $5 million on the damages verdict.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But, sure. I mean, you're right, that they talk about Autoliv and whether they've made out the case, but he does ultimately conclude that the bid data used by Levko to form his damages opinion was separate and independent from the Grand Blanc facility plant-wide financial data. Isn't that conclusion sufficient to satisfy, assuming they have a burden under Jordan or whatever, of clear and convincing evidence? Isn't that finding sufficient?
No, Judge, I submit it's not, because Mr. Levko himself testified in the court in another section of his opinion, quoted it, where he relied on Grand Blanc plant financials up to and including June 30th, 2003, and those financials were misstated.
Those were just used as a check on his other numbers.
Excuse me, Your Honor, if I can just... At page 118 of the appendix, Judge, Mr. Levko testified, and I'm reading from page 29 of the transcript. Question, and in order to back out from those bid sheets the dollars that you believed were attributable to fixed cost, you relied on the Vemco plant-wide income statements for 1996 through June 30, 2003. Is that not correct? I used them in my calculations, yes, to do the analysis. But I also looked at the actual studies of these programs which show the contribution margin. Question, did you use the actual studies to make your calculation? Answer, I used them to check. That's the actual studies. Question, answer, you did not use the actual studies to make your calculation. Answer, I used the financial statements to actually, as I said, categorize the cost. Question, so the financial statements were the data. The plant-wide financial statements are the data on which you relied in actually making the calculations you submitted to the jury, not the studies you referred to. Answer, that's correct. I used the studies as a check. The actual plant-wide calculations he used.
If we were to hypothetically agree with you that there was prejudice here on the B3 theory, why should that result in anything more than a new trial on the damages issue?
I believe that's what it would result in, Judge. I would agree with that.
Does Judge Lynn have any questions?
Thank you. I think you've covered all of my issues.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll restore your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with the last discussion, because without reading this in some context, it gets a little confusing. Mr. Levko was being questioned about the way in which he used the plant-wide financial statements, unaudited plant-wide financial statements. That's an important point. He was using the unaudited, and those appear at Trial Exhibit 7247. And those unaudited financial statements were what he was utilizing to do two things. And in this case, the colloquy that goes back and forth between Mr. Levko and counsel concerns the ratio between fixed and variable cost. And the ratio between fixed and variable cost is not impacted by increase or decrease in production costs. It remains the same. And that argument about ratios was really abandoned by Autoliv in the proceeding below, because Mr. Levko has offered testimony, unrebutted testimony, that the ratios are not impacted by the changes that were made in the inventory and payables issues in connection with the plant.
Okay, but let's leave that a moment and go back to our earlier discussion with Mr. Green, which
yes.
was the involved the legal standard that was applied to analyze this evidence.
Yes.
You would agree, would you not, that the district court's judge's analysis of Mr. Lefko's testimony and all of this information was in the context of whether or not Autoliv had met its burden to show that there would have been a different result, correct?
I believe that the judge's finding, which is reflected in his opinion at pages 63 of the appendix, 62 of the appendix, he says, Autoliv has not...
Which page of the opinion is
that? I'm sorry.
Page 8 of the opinion?
No, but I'm my copy is the copy that's attached to the blue brief.
The appendix?
This is the judge's opinion you're talking about.
It's page 8.
Page 8.
Thank
yes.
you.
ADD
9. Okay.
He concludes in discussing the 60B3 analysis.
60B2.
Right. No, I'm now looking at the section above the 60B2 section.
Okay.
The last paragraph.
Okay.
Based on the record, Autoliv has not come close to establishing a likelihood that fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct occurred during the pretrial that would cause the court to consider a further evidentiary hearing on its B3 claim or granting a new trial on damages.
Okay, well, let's assume then that we've established that there's fraud, and so the prong remaining is whether or not that would have affected it. Would you agree then with the other side that under Jordan and elsewhere it would have been your burden, therefore, to come forward with clear and convincing evidence that it did not affect the trial?
That is not the law of the Sixth Circuit. It is, as the court is well aware, the Jordan case is an unpublished decision that creates this burden shifting that does not exist anywhere else in Sixth Circuit authority. In fact, the standard, as the court I'm sure is aware, is that It may have. It may have affected the impact. That is the standard in virtually all the other circuits that have addressed this issue.
Well, in our cases, in Frage and Schreiber, we seem to say that we're not going to speculate as to whether it had an effect. If there was B3 misconduct, that may be the end of it.
Well, and that is certainly, the court has brought to our attention the Schreiber case. And that's what the Schreiber case says. This court is well aware of what the Schreiber case says. Has the court had the benefit of the supplemental filing that we filed in connection with the question that was submitted?
I don't think we've received anything.
It was submitted overnight and by fax.
Overnight last night?
No, overnight for receipt yesterday and by fax.
Well, we don't have it, so.
I'm sorry that you don't, because I want to discuss why this is not a Schreiber case. It is not a Schreiber.
But before we get on to that, this part that you read from page 8 of the district court's opinion strikes me, or hurts you, because he's saying there's not sufficient misconduct here that would cause the court to consider a further evidentiary hearing. In other words, he's declining to consider the issue of prejudice. That's the way I understand what he's saying. Isn't that a problem for you?
It is not, because in the first instance, he's concluded two things. At page 63, he concludes that there is no fraud, that there is no misrepresentation, and that there is no misconduct. At page 75, he concludes...
And he says after that, in the part that you read, I'm not going to hold a hearing, basically he's saying, on the question of prejudice.
Well, that is... I don't read it that way, Judge. He does not say that.
Even beyond that, this section in his opinion I read as dealing with the question of discovery misconduct.
It is the only misconduct that was argued by Autoliv. It's the only misconduct that was argued by Autoliv.
But you don't even raise in your response brief. You suggest that this was the main focus, but you're not making an argument that they waived the right to raise this or that it wasn't properly raised below and therefore they can't raise it here, right?
Well, discovery misconduct was the only issue that was framed and the only issue that was argued and the only issue that was considered.
Well, how do we know that? Is the motion in the appendix?
The motion is not in the appendix, but it is in the docket. So
you're saying that motion doesn't raise it?
Does not raise this issue. The court's question is the first time...
Well, we can't resolve that today. I think ask the parties to submit copies of that motion so we can tell whether it was raised or not.
Thank you, Judge. But let me tell you why this is not a Schreiber case. This is not a Schreiber case because there were no false statements. There were no false statements in this case. Because in this instance, the audited financial opinion of Deloitte Touche remains a clean opinion. It has not been withdrawn.
I don't understand what you're saying. What do you mean there's no... The financials were admittedly incorrect.
No, they were not.
They were not?
The financials, if you look at Appendix 189, this is the report of Doran Mayhew. And this is the reason that... this is a very important point. Doran Mayhew, in Appendix 189, in the last paragraph, as part of this forensic investigation, we are not engaged to and did not perform an audit for purposes of expressing an opinion in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards. They are not challenging the audited opinion of Deloitte Touche.
But that is somewhat startling to me. I mean, I thought the whole point of this report is that the financial statements were not correct, and in fact they said we can't even tell whether the earlier ones are correct or not because we haven't done a full investigation.
No, that is not what Doran Mayhew says. And if I could draw the court's attention to Appendix 185, where it treats precisely what is at issue, and it is a very narrow point. And it's the first paragraph at the top, second sentence. The work we performed included the process of identifying related party transactions and investigating the nature of each transaction in order to determine whether the transaction was considered on no less favorable terms to the debtor than would be obtained if the transaction were an arm's-length transaction with a non-affiliated entity. I just want to make this point. The related party transactions were fully disclosed in the audited financial statements in the opinion of Deloitte Touche. And you could see Appendix 939 for an example of that.
Well, I mean, focusing back to your brief, it seemed to me, and maybe I misread it, I mean, I'm not understanding, on page 53 of your brief, you're discussing the audited consolidated financials of Venture Holdings for 96 to 2001.
Yes.
And I think I read it as, that's what we're talking about here, as being the problematic documents. And your answer was, not these documents were fine and there was nothing wrong with them, but trying to argue that Mr. Levko really didn't rely on them.
So
what am I missing? Okay.
I'm sorry, Judge, that I wasn't clear. If you look at page 56 of our brief,
right,
the footnote, and actually we mentioned it earlier, as noted super, the audited financials of Venture Holdings for 1996 to 2001 still carry an unqualified opinion from Deloitte Touche.
Well, what does that mean?
It means they have not withdrawn their opinion, Judge. And the reason they have not withdrawn their opinion is that Doran Mayhew does not offer an audited analysis of the...
They haven't redone the financial statements. That's clear enough. But haven't they said that the financial statements are inaccurate?
No, they have... Judge, when you say they, Doran Mayhew has not said that. Doran Mayhew...
Hasn't the company said that the financial statements are inaccurate? Didn't they advise the SEC that the statements were inaccurate and they couldn't be relied on?
If you will look at the 8K, Judge, and that is at Appendix 590. And let's start at the beginning. After listing the parties, it begins about the middle of the paragraph. The debtors and the official committee of unsecured creditors of Venture Holdings as co-plaintiffs filed suit on April 5th, 2004 in the bankruptcy court against Larry J. Winget. This 8K is filed in connection with the announcement of a lawsuit. And this is a very significant point because the preceding bulk of the 8K then simply lists the allegations in the lawsuit. When we get to the language that you're focusing on, Judge, which is on page 592, in the first full unnumbered paragraph, the last sentence, it says, in light of the information contained in the Doran Mayhew report, it appears that the financial information previously publicly reported is unreliable. But let's go back to the Doran Mayhew report.
We shouldn't believe them?
No, Judge, you should believe them, but you should believe them only with respect to what they opined on. And let me tell you what that is.
Here's the company saying it appears that financial information previously publicly reported by Venture Holdings as far back as 1998 is unreliable and should not be relied on. Are we not supposed to believe what the company says about its own audited financial statement?
Judge, what we are to believe is that it appears, in light of the Doran Mayhew report. Now, we've got to go back to the Doran Mayhew report. What does the Doran Mayhew report say in its conclusions? And I would draw the court's attention to page 187. This is the appendix. Sub G, last sentence. In conclusion, we have quantified the results of our findings and make a recommendation as to a potential claim against the affiliated entity or outsider. Look at the block, on page 190, above the signature block. Above the signature block on 190. This report is intended to be used solely by the Venture Board of Directors in connection with our forensic investigation of Venture Holdings LLC transactions with affiliated entities and insiders, and in support of any further litigation asserting the claims identified within our report. This report focuses on identifying loss claims.
Okay, but let's assume hypothetically. I think we grasp your point about this. Let's assume hypothetically that we reject it and we say that the financial statements were false. Why don't we have to send it back to Judge Cohen to consider the issue of prejudice under B3?
Because the court has already found in its opinion, at page appendix 75, it has already found precisely the point that I made just a few moments ago.
And which page of the opinion is this?
I'm sorry, that's page 21 of the opinion, Judge.
Yeah.
Now, the paragraph at the top of the page, the last sentence. And this is quite significant because it picks up on precisely the point I was just making as taken from the Doran-Mahey report. The March 10th Doran-Mahey report disclosed not mismanagement of financial accounts of Venture, but rather overreaching by Venture's principal stockholders. Nothing in this report casts any doubt on the financial accounts of the Grand Rapids facility. And here is his point.
Yeah, wait. But that's talking about the March 10th Mahey report. And in the, if you keep reading, the next paragraph says, while the March 25th Mahey report casts some doubt on the financial accounts.
Judge, and the reason that I was focusing on the March 10 report is it is the March 10 report that I read from just a few moments ago that appears in Appendix 189 and 190.
But let me ask...
Didn't
the judge conclude that there was evidence that there was some doubt on the financial accounts at the Grand Blanc facility?
He's talking about the unaudited statements there, Judge. The March 25th report relates to the subsequent examination of the unaudited statements where there are some inventory and payables issues. And he treats those extensively in his opinion. The March 10th report, the court concludes, it doesn't talk about the integrity of the financial information. And this is quite important because Mr. Levko's testimony at trial was only that I took comfort that there was an audited financial opinion, that there was an unqualified opinion out there. He says, I didn't rely on them to develop the information about what happens at the Grand Blanc facility. And this is exactly what the court is saying here. It's saying there's a disconnect. Even if you accept that there are related party transactions, meaning the company's profits would have been higher, it doesn't tell me anything about the Grand Blanc facility. And why is that? Because the consolidated audited financials consolidate 10 different entities. This case turns on one plant and one company. The audited financials are entirely attenuated from the analysis that was done in this case. And I'd like to make one other point. The court said and found the financial statements in the March 25th that are subject to the March 25th report.
You're out of time. Why don't you try to wrap it up? Okay. You can finish the point you're making.
Thank you. The court made the point that the plant financial statements were not the source of Mr. Levko's analysis. In fact, he uses the words at page 64 of the appendix that the data that he used was raw data that was specific and reliable. And the point is this. The plant-wide data included not only the subject of a lawsuit, which is these little airbag covers, but bumpers, which are 66% of the plant production. There is a disconnect between using any plant-wide information and trying to figure out what your damages are on airbag covers. There is a further attenuation when you take this plant information and roll it into 10 companies in a consolidated report. Getting back to Judge Cohn's...
Okay, well, I think that's about enough.
Thank you,
Mr. Hennig. Mr. Green? Oh, I actually should ask Judge Lynn if he has any questions here.
No, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Responding to the court's question as to whether we argued beyond discovery misconduct in B3, the answer, as I said in my opening argument, is yes.
Is the place to find that in the motion?
The place to find it, I think, most clearly is at 491 of the docket, which is a supplemental brief that was submitted after the April 29th hearing, and it's identified at page A51 of the transcript, Your Honor. It's that brief that I think most clearly capsulizes the argument that was advanced to the court.
What page is this again?
It's at page A51 of the appendix.
A51.
Judge, and it's docket entry 491. It's the last item on that page in the appendix.
Why don't you supply us with a copy of that document?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. The only other point I would like to make is, as the court's question has indicated, there are two categories of financial documents as to which there were misstatements. The audited financial statements of the entity as a whole and the Grand Blanc statements. Our position on the audited financial statements is once the company advised the SEC that they're unreliable, we think any argument as to their reliability after that lacks merit. As to the Grand Blanc financial statements, which Mr. Levko used up to and including June 2003, the record itself establishes that not only were they false, as Doran Mayhew indicated, that subsequent to the trial, Venture restated those financials. Those are the unaudited financials, and that's at Appendix 819. I have nothing further to add unless the court has additional questions.
No, but what about counsel? Does Judge Lynn have anything?
Thanks. No, nothing further.
Okay. If counsel could just remain seated for one moment. Subject to objection from Judge Lynn, we'd like the parties to submit supplemental briefs 2 weeks from today, no more than 10 double-spaced pages in length, limited to a single question, and that is, for purposes of B3, what is the standard for prejudice under Sixth Circuit law? And I think you should include in that the question of whether we can properly consider under our rules the Jordan case, since it's unpublished. Okay? Thank you both.
2 weeks from today.
2 weeks from today.
Thank you very much.
Is that all right with Judge Lynn?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Okay, thank you.